history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be heard if we'll take the time to ask a few questions and listen. We really want to make sure our veterans know that we're thankful for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And on that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We learn a ton. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Sonora, California, home to Joe Haritani, a veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II. You've heard about the Gopher Broke unit before. We've heard from a lot of Nisei veterans. But let's hear Joe's story. So you were the son of a preacher. Your dad was a Methodist minister?
That's right, yeah. His first church was in Washington State, Tacoma. And then they moved to Loomis, California. And I went through grammar school in Loomis. And then from there, we moved to Livingston. I went to high school there. And then from there, after graduation in 1941, I think, I went to started in Modesto Junior College. And that was when December 7th happened. And we were evacuated and put to concentration camps.
And I want to hear all about that, but I want to hear a little bit about the earlier years, too. So your father's a minister, and you had a lot of siblings, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. The eldest was my sister Mary. She's gone. My brother James, who's also gone. Then me, and below me, Thomas, he's also gone. And then sister Grace, she's the widow. And then sister Irene, also a widow. And then the youngest was David, and I think he's now a grandparent. Hard to imagine. Seven kids.
And I'm sure they were counting along as you went through the names. Yeah, seven kids, and you were toward the top of that. What do you remember about that childhood? What were the things that you said, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
I just remember in Florence, California, going strawberry picking. And the other thing I remember about Florence was that it was the first time I saw little minnows in a ditch and a pool near the church. I don't know why, but that made a big impression on me. Anyway, after a few years in Florence, then we moved to Livingston, California. I went to high school in Livingston, graduated in 41 to Modesto Junior College.
I always remember Livingston because that's the first place I ever hit a home run in high school, playing for the Los Banas Tigers, yep. But there was quite a substantial Japanese-American population there, right?
Yes. I think there's a history of some rich Japanese from Japan bought a large acreage in the Livingston Cortez area. He either sold little like 40-acre farms to different Japanese who were immigrating into the U.S. I grew up in Livingston through high school, and all of my neighbors were farmers, mostly fruit trees like peaches. Anyway, after I graduated from high school, then I started Modesto Junior College. That's when World War II started.
So, and I know some of what happened after that, but I'm curious, in high school, did you ever experience any kind of discrimination? Were you treated differently because your last name was Japanese?
No, high school was really great. In fact, I had a Caucasian girlfriend in high school who were active in sports. Livingston, I think the high school population was only about 400, so it was a small school. Yeah, it was good times back then.
So you go to Modesto Junior College, and what were you studying? What were you hoping to do?
Well, I started studying engineering. My family didn't have money. I mean, my father being a preacher, poor preacher. I did the same thing that my older sister did. Worked in homes, do the dishes, help cook, clean the house, and I did the same thing for a while.
So in order to have a place to stay while you're going to college, you would do the household chores for that family you were staying with?
Yeah, and my family had a furniture store in Modesto, and after the war broke out, they put their heads together and then told me that I'm going to have to move out because if the people who were their customers found out that they were harboring a Japanese, they would not give them business. So I was lucky there was another guy from Livingston, a guy named Harry Makita, and he was paying a small amount or working for a little converted garage that he had lived in. He let me move in with him, and I continued in MJC.
Do you remember that day itself, December 7th? Do you remember how you found out what happened?
It was on the news. And the fact that my employers, when they heard about it, then they told me that I had to move out, because they didn't want to lose their business.
But so you find another place to live, and you're still going to school there at Modesto Junior College. But I imagine things started to change, and what you were allowed to do as a Japanese American probably changed.
Basically, the other students were very generous and didn't really discriminate. But then there was a war order that made all Japanese Americans move out of California, and they set up what they call detention camps. I think the total of 10, two in California, Tule Lake in Northern California, and Manzanar near the Nevada border. The other eight, the one I was sent to was in Colorado near a town called Granada, and they called the camp Amachi. And there are about 12,000 of us camped in that behind barbed wire and with guard towers and guards up in the tower with the guns and keep us from, trying to escape. And Tule Camp, one man tried to escape, and as he was going under the barbed wire, they shot him, killed him. Yeah, but that's the only one that happened.
So here you're born in America, you've gone to school with everybody else, they didn't had to treat you any differently, and now all of a sudden when there's a war, they see what your last name looks like, and well, you're not an American anymore. And tell me about what you guys had to do in Livingston. You went to your dad's church and you tried to store away some of your belongings?
Yeah, there's a main church building, a social hall building, and a third building that had a basement. What we did when we were being evacuated, we moved new things that were precious to us, put it in the basement under the third building, and sealed it, and I put a board across and nailed it shut. But it was all gone when he got back.
Well, and do you remember what that felt like to be basically ripped away from your life and made a prisoner, not knowing how long this is going to last, and you had your parents and six siblings that were in the same boat?
Yeah, but I don't know. At that age, just starting out college, it didn't really sink in till much later. And I remember in camp that a bunch of us college-age kids, we formed our own little gang and just played around together. Yeah, in fact, we formed like a baseball team and played baseball. But it was something that we just were able to accept and not to really get too angry about it. We just took it as it came and did whatever we could to enjoy ourselves.
What position did you play in baseball?
I was mostly in the outfield. I was not a very good athlete, so other better people were pitching and on the bases and catching, yeah.
And when you say you just took it as it came, you didn't let it bother you too much, Do you think that was influenced by your parents and how they handled it?
Yeah, they, my dad being a Methodist minister, my mother was from a rich family in the North Island of Hokkaido. Her father owned a lot of territory, including a small town. And I remember my mother telling me that her father was very kind to the townspeople that lived in his town. And she also told me about going with her older brother salmon spearing on the town, on the river up in Hokkaido. And then she finally started junior college in Tokyo. That's where she met my father, and that's where they got married.
What was the most challenging aspect of life in that internment camp? What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
Actually, once we moved in and set up our barracks and maybe had something like 8 rooms in each barrack, our family had something like 8 of us, so we got something like 2 or 3 rooms and put up sheets to separate the rooms. Actually, we used to hold dances in the mess hall, and so we, had our own social activities that took up our interest, and we didn't feel so angry anymore. We just tried to enjoy life.
So at what point did you start thinking, hey, maybe I can go serve our country? Even though this country is holding me and my family prisoner behind barbed wire, I think I'm going to go serve.
Well, president at the time was FDR. He had all the Japanese lose our citizenship and our draft status, instead of, people who couldn't be drafted were called 4F. They made us 4Cs, enemy aliens. But after a while, I think because the war wasn't going too well, and he decided to draft us out of the camp. And I and another fellow from my camp from Los Angeles, we just volunteered. We said, we're not going to wait to be drafted. And I remember this is in Granada, Colorado, and they put us on trucks, took us out of camp down to the Granada Trace Station. It took us up to Denver, Colorado, to be inducted, and from Denver put on trains, took us down to New Orleans, Louisiana, and Camp Shelby. That's where we ended up training as infantrymen.
How did your parents feel about your decision to join the Army?
Oh, they accepted it. They thought maybe it's better than being stuck in camp doing nothing, just maybe even getting into trouble. No, they weren't, I guess. They thought it was probably the best thing to do, get me out of camp.
And did any of your brothers end up serving too, or no?
My older brother was already in the Army, and he was in training, I think, in New Jersey. And my older sister, the eldest one, his older sister Mary, she was a nurse, and she was already evacuated from the camp and was working as a nurse in some small town in New York State.
Was there any thought or consideration on your part that if you went and put on that uniform and fought for this country, that maybe justice would finally come to your family, that you could prove your loyalty or prove your worthiness as an American?
Well, I was too young to think about all these wonderful things I might have. No, I didn't think about it. I just took life as it is and volunteered. So I didn't really consider much about what was going to happen to the family.
And so you end up serving with the 442nd, famously all Japanese American unit, the most decorated unit from World War II. Did you make some friends right away with these other Japanese-American young men who were kind of in the same boat as you were?
The 442nd was formed in Hawaii. The Japanese-Americans in Hawaii, they were already being trained ahead of time before I went down to join them in Camp Shelby. So they made fun of us and said that these Japanese Americans from the States, you hit them on the head, they go kotonk. They called us kotonks. They thought that was funny.
Do you remember the first time you heard that slogan, go for broke? And did you know what it meant?
Yeah, I think so. We knew that going all out was a phrase that I think was very popular. You know, like they use it for actually the Hawaiian Japanese did a lot of crap shooting, and they'd always say, go for broke, go for broke. You know, that was their motto, and that's where we picked it up.
So what about friendships? Did you make some good buddies there at Camp Shelby?
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of my closest friend, a guy named Johnny Yamamoto from Los Angeles, we were sort of like fox old buddies. I think most of us paired off with a buddy. I think kind of look after each other. Well, I remember that we were running short of water in our canteen, so I volunteered for our squad to go down to the valley. I saw people walking across with the canteens, so I got the canteens from my squad and took off and went down there and found that there was a well off to the right, and there was even a bucket and a rope on it so that we could fill up our canteens. But came back and they said, don't look, don't look. I said, what happened? They said, Johnny got shot. He was dead. And it just really broke me up, and my best buddy was shot and killed from an artillery shell, actually. Anyway, after that, I think I took up with this guy that was from Los Angeles as my next buddy.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt, but we need to catch our first break. And I also think that we're going to need to revisit that tragic incident you just mentioned so we all understand the implications for you. Joe Haritani of Sonora, California is our guest today. You can pull up some photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest brand branches in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a visit today with 93-year-old Joe Haritani of Sonora, California, a veteran of the famed 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II. Eventually, roughly 14,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry served in that go-for-broke unit during the war. That group earned a total of nearly 9,500 Purple Hearts. Think about that statistic for a while. By the way, if your travels are going to take you to Los Angeles and that area over the next few weeks, there is a free exhibit of photographs, portrait-style photos, of 442nd veterans called Portraits of Courage by Shane Sato. It features 81 different Nisei vets, and it's in LA's Little Tokyo District at the headquarters of the Go for Broke National Education Center through June 10th. I've got a link to that information up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But why don't we dive back into Joe Haritani's story? He'd been pulled out of college by Executive Order 9066 and sent to the Granada War Relocation Center in Colorado. From behind barbed wire there, he volunteered to serve the same country that was holding his family prisoner. By the first day of May in 1944, he was leaving Newport News, Virginia to sail across the Atlantic and into combat with the 442nd.
It was a large fleet, I think something like 90 ships, all going across the Atlantic to North Africa. We landed in Oran, and then we were put on British troop ship to go across the Mediterranean to Italy. And I remember they served us breakfast in a British ship, and it was fish and chips. And, you know, we couldn't take it. We just all threw it away. And we landed in Naples and marched up to a town called Grosseto. And from there, we went into action, fought all the way up to Florence on the Florence River. And from there, they shipped us out of Italy and shipped us in troop ships to Marseille, France, and went on trucks up to Belmont and went back into action in France.
And you were in a mortar platoon?
Yes, 81 milliliter mortars. There were three parts, the bipod and then the mortar tube and the base plate. And I ended up carrying the base plate. It weighed 45 pounds. It was kind of heavy and it had the strap, so I'd strap it to my back over my shoulder.
So you guys would have to find a spot to set that up. And then if it's time, if you're told fire at this location, what would you do? What was your job?
We made sure that we were under trees, because if the mortar shell hit a limb or something, it would bloom. I mean, it would explode right on our heads. So we had to move to clear areas. And I remember that our frontline infantry were lined up on a ridge of a hill, and they couldn't move because they're coming under artillery fire. And so we moved up behind them and we started lobbing mortar shells into where the troops, the enemy troops, were coming. And we forced them to retreat and go back so that our troops could move forward. Yeah, it's very effective. Those mortar shells are very dangerous, you might say.
And that's one of the things that makes you a target, too. The enemy would like to take you guys out and take out that mortar. And when you tell the story of Johnny Yamamoto and coming back and they won't let you see your best buddy's body, you said that was an artillery shell that hit the same location where you were before you left to go get those canteens. So what would have happened to you if you were still there?
I would have been gone. Yeah, because we were in the same slit trench, you know, right next to each other. So just lucky, I guess. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made it.
And I'm sure that wasn't the only close call that you experienced. In fact, at one point, you ended up with a little shrapnel inside of you as well?
Yeah, I think we were under artillery fire again, and artillery burst down below me and ducked my head, and shrapnel hit my helmet, but I got one little shrapnel in my chest. Just like the tip of my finger, little finger. And I didn't even know it because, you know, you're in shock. And it was much later when I was off the line and going to take a shower. I noticed this little, like a scar, pull a little piece of shrapnel. And I saved it for a long time. And finally, I don't know when I lost it.
You know, the 442nd. It has become legendary for the courage, for the bravery, also for the casualties. An inordinate number of casualties suffered by a unit that wasn't that big. So it must not have been a one-time situation. When you talk about Johnny Yamamoto, there must have been other friends who you lost over there too.
Oh, yeah, because I would buddy up with another guy, Frank Shigemori. He was from Washington State, one of the few in our outfit from out of California. There weren't very many Japanese Americans in Washington or Oregon. Most of us were from California. Most of our company were from Hawaii.
When you guys made it to the Arno River, that's when Frank was killed?
The Arno, yeah. He was killed with artillery, yeah.
Well, and what about you and your mindset? Did you ever sit there in that foxhole and hear everything that was happening and wonder if you were going to make it?
No, we're just too busy trying to stay alive. I mean, we just hoped that you could see the next day, but we didn't really focus on being killed. It just happens, and you could do nothing about it. So we let it go at that.
And while you were over there in Italy and later in France, did you ever receive mail from your family back at the camp?
No, I never got a letter. I never wrote. I never received anything from my family or friends at all. I was just isolated, you might say, and not worried about family back home.
Was there something that you think helped you endure that, or that kept you going, or that motivated you during that difficult time?
Well, I just felt that, life just goes on, and if your luck holds, you'll see the next day and the next day beyond that, and not worry about it. Basically, you just worried about getting your rations every day to keep alive and keep your water canteen so you can keep drinking water and staying alive. That was it. I mean, you didn't look at the whole big picture. You just thought about your own existence and your buddy's existence and just keep fit and ready to rejoin the battle whenever it took you to a new area.
Well, and I want to talk to you about one of those areas, Bruyere, and what you experienced there. But on that topic we are just covering, I'm just curious, since your dad was a preacher and you grew up in church, did faith play a role at all for you? Did you have some expectation that God was on your side or would protect you?
No, I didn't feel that way at all. My dad did his Sunday service in Japanese, and there was a young people's service separately from our parents, and we had older second generation Japanese who taught us in church. I don't think we understood Japanese that well because we never used it.
So you guys, this is October 1944, you guys are in the area of Bruyere, France, and your battalion was told to take a hill. Hill B was your guy's target?
Yeah, we more or less crawled and took up position. I remember it started to rain. I had to dug a slit trench, and I put the tree limbs on the bottom to keep me out of the water because it was filling up with water. Yeah, but anyway, we were able to move forward from there.
Well, and it was not long after that that the 442nd had the incident that it has become most famous for, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, where so many of these Japanese-American soldiers were wounded or even killed, rescuing some Caucasian soldiers, mostly from Texas. That rescue of the Lost Battalion, and you weren't there for it, right?
Yeah. The Texans were trapped behind enemy lines. I think they're running short of ammunition because they've been there probably two or three days. So this was a Texas battalion. So the Texas division called us from where we were to come in and try to rescue them. We fought the Germans who were holding them captive, and finally got the Germans to retreat because we were putting up a lot of fire, mortar fire and rifle fire. So they finally got the Texans back out and got them freed from behind the lines.
Yeah, and we've heard from some of those rescuers as well as some of those who were rescued here on this program over the years. There were more than 800 go-for-broke soldiers from the 442nd who ended up being killed or wounded in the process of saving fewer than 250 of those men from the Lost Battalion. And who knows, perhaps you would have been one of those casualties, but you happened to be back in the hospital and missed that whole incident. And that's because of a back injury that still bothers you now and had flared up at the time. What happened there, Joe? How'd you hurt your back?
Well, that was in training. I fell from, we used to, part of the training was to go climb up a tall wall, wooden wall, and I fell and hit my butt and squashed one of the vertebrae. So they sent me down to LaGuardia General Hospital in New Orleans, and they operated on my back on that spine.
So when you were over in Europe fighting, that would act up on you?
Oh, well, you know, I just got used to living with it, so I didn't even focus. I never even thought about it anymore.
But it flared up to the point where you had to go to a hospital?
Yeah, I had taken off the line somewhere along the way. And I remember going on a train and being treated for my spine, but I don't have any real specific recollection about that.
But before the war ended in Europe, you actually got transferred to another company handling oxygen cylinders?
What happened? It was a chemical company that produced oxygen for welding and also for breathing. I forget, there's some sort of chemical mixture, and by adding certain chemicals, oxygen gas would come out of that, would trap it into cylinders and send them to the hospital. It was a strange job.
Well, and it was probably different also because you go from a unit that's all Japanese-American to now you're probably the only Japanese-American with a bunch of Caucasians?
I was, actually. But one of the guys in the platoon or the squad that I was in, he was really cut-up type of kid. He sort of made good friends with me, and I remember we would wrestle. I remember one time we were on these folding beds, you know, like camp beds that fold out. I guess I fell on that, and he jumped on top of me and just tore the fabric all in half. I fell out. Yeah, the strange things we did.
Did that take getting used to, serving with white soldiers after being segregated into the all Nisei unit?
No, they were very friendly. I remember going on leave with two Caucasian friends, and we went back down to, I think, northern coast of Italy, just taking sort of like almost like a vacation.
And what about when the war ended, when you got news, hey, Germany has surrendered? What kind of feeling did that produce for you?
I was with this Caucasian. They called it a gas generation company producing oxygen gas. And I think we're actually not in the fighting. You know, we're always behind the line. So actually, it was no big change for us. Just to notice that the fighting was over. Yeah.
Well, and you were probably starting to think, hey, when do I get to go home, right?
But the thing is that, you know, home was no longer home because the whole family, all the others, were still in the concentration camps, in our case, in Colorado. So I think by that time, while I was still waiting to be discharged, they were finally able to go back to California, and my parents went back to the church and the parsonage in Livingston. And when I got discharged, they sent me from New England, flew me all the way to outside Marysville, California, where I got discharged. And I remember in my uniform, I had a pack sack. They had this, it was actually a civilian bus with a lot of veterans in it and also civilians. When I tried to get on, all the seats were taken. And the bus driver said, "We got to get out. There's no room." And the woman sitting on the front seat by the steps said, "Let him sit here. Let him go." And so he let me sit on the steps there, closed the door, and we went and got back home. And I got off in Livingston and walked home. Knocked on the front door and surprised that my mother and father were there. My mother said, "There's a robber at the..." And he looked and said, "No, it's Joe." Oh, so that was our reunion, yeah.
And there's another layer to that I think we need to share with our listeners, but it's break time again. If you'd like to see what that robber, Joe, looked like in uniform during World War II, and of course what he looks like now, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll also explore his post-military duties in the U.S. Foreign Service and the impact that had. Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 93-year-old Joe Haritani of Sonora, California, a veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II, a veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II. And you know, I want to thank Chase Anderson for introducing me to Joe. Chase wrote an outstanding piece about Joe for Friends and Neighbors magazine in California's Gold Country. I have it linked for you on our website, hometownheroesradio.com. And that article is why I know there's another wrinkle to this story of Joe's post-war return to Livingston, California, where his parents had just returned after finally being set free from the Amache internment camp in Colorado. I read that they weren't even sure you were still alive. There was a report earlier that you had been killed when Johnny was killed. Is that right?
Yeah, they thought it was me who was killed, and whoever reported that it was me that was killed.
So the report went back to your parents, and you said you never wrote your parents during the whole war. So your mother and father didn't know if you were alive or dead.
Oh, they thought I was dead. Yeah. But, you know, we were in a big family with 7 kids, so it's not as bad as a family with just 1 or 2. Anyway,
I think it's still a pretty big deal if you think you lost your son, especially while you're locked up behind barbed wire. So your mother thinks you're a robber, then your dad says it's Joe. She must have had quite a reaction to that if she's thinking you're dead.
Well, yeah, they went to the front window and peeked down and saw me, and I was in uniform. So they knew right there it was not a robber.
But as you said earlier, all those things, those keepsakes, those heirlooms, those valuables that you had stowed away in the basement of that social hall, they're all gone.
There's nothing left. I think they even left the door open. It didn't matter because everything was taken out. So yeah, we're sad about that. Whatever nice things that we had saved is all gone. And I think people from the town or farmers living near us took those things, and we never saw them again.
Was it hard to jump back into life again, or was that a relief that your time in the military is over and you can think about having a life again?
Well, when I got back, I really didn't know what to do. I had nothing to do because we weren't farmers. We didn't have a farm, and my father had his church, and my mother also helped him with the church. But what happened was I was there for, I guess, a couple of weeks, and an old friend from high school who was working as a gardener in Los Angeles area. I guess he heard I was back in Livingston, so he drove up. We got together and talked about it, and I think he stayed overnight or something. And he said, why don't you come back with me down to Los Angeles area and gardening and do gardening with me? I said, well, why not? I don't have anything else to do. So I went back with him and started working with him in people's garden, cutting the lawn, taking care of shrubs, watering, that sort of thing. And I did that for maybe a year or two, and I got tired of that. So I went back home. I guess that's when I went back to Modesto Junior College.
Well, I guess it's a good thing you went back to Modesto Junior College, because isn't that where you met your wife?
Yes, she was a student there, and a lot of the Nisei, we call them, they're second generation Japanese who were born in the States. Most of them, you know, off of farms, and my wife was also, and they would get jobs in the wealthier families in the Modesto, what they call them, school girls, and they would help cook, wash, laundry, if they had a little kid, take care of babysitting, and I did the same thing, except I didn't do any cooking. And I remember the family had this furniture store. They had a large closet, and they put a bed in there for me to sleep. Yeah, that was my home.
So what was it about Amy that caught your eye, and when did you realize that she had been at the Merced Assembly Center at the same time as you and at the concentration camp in Amachi at the same time?
I didn't know her there. They were in a different part, one far end of the camp. But at the Modesto Junior College, there were just a few Japanese Americans. So we would get together, you know, in the library or wherever, because they worked in homes, so we couldn't, you know, get together in their home. But I guess I finally fell in love with her. And recruiters from Stanford University, I don't know why, but I was interviewed by them. I guess because I was a veteran, and maybe they wanted some veterans in their student body. They offered to have me attend Stanford at their cost. So I moved from Modesto to Stanford, and at about the same time, my future wife moved down to San Jose State University, went to school there. While I was at Stanford, I got a job working for a fairly rich family in a suburb of Palo Alto. The name was Treat, T-R-E-A-T, and they're really good to me. They had a little cottage room in extension of their garage, and that's where I lived. Finally, I graduated from Stanford, and then a couple of other classmates decided to go to UC Berkeley, and I thought, well, I'll go there and also get a master's degree, which I did.
Well, and how long have you two been married now?
We got married in 1948.
And you had some fascinating work after that. You worked for USAID. Tell people what that is and what you did.
Well, I was a sanitary engineer, worked in public health, and mostly in water supply. The first country that we were stationed in was in Bolivia, in South America, and I would go around to the small towns. We had a well drilling team, and we would drill deep wells and put either a windmill or a hand pump onto the well so that people could get water, because they were most... A lot of the small towns, they didn't have any water supply at all. They had a stream or something where the wife would go out in the bucket and get water and bring it back home, cook with it. So that this is a big improvement. They got good fresh water out of the well.
And you did the same thing in Nicaragua and Vietnam. That must have been satisfying to have such an impact on so many people's lives.
Oh, yes, but in Vietnam, I started doing something else besides water supply, setting up health centers where we'd have nurses and sanitary engineers providing basic health care to the townspeople. And I remember covering South Vietnam, quite a few. I forget how many provinces, but we covered them all.
And then you worked for the Peace Corps, too?
Yes, I worked first in Ecuador. You know, my background as a sanitary engineer, I was always in water supply. We would sometimes tap a spring and build like a dam to a pipeline and bring the pipeline down to the village and collect water in a pool so the women can come with their buckets and supply water for the family.
Well, I guess if you spent your whole career in water, you decided to come to a place where where you can still see the results of hydraulic mining from 170 years ago now in the gold rush?
Well, we first moved to Colombia because during one of our home leaves from South America, my wife and I realized that when we finally left the Foreign Service, we didn't have to find a place to live here. But we didn't move there right away till after we finished our Peace Corps service.
Well, and I'm curious too, all that work you did around the world, and it wasn't just traveling the world, it was helping people who were in a real difficult situation who didn't have clean water to drink, and you're helping supply clean water for them in places like South America and Southeast Asia. Did those experiences give you a different perspective or appreciation about America and about being an American?
Oh, yeah. I thought that we're really lucky. I mean, you know, especially being a Japanese American, if our parents didn't come here, we would be in Japan under occupation.
Yeah.
So it was, we never thought about it that way, but that's how it would have been.
Well, and speaking of, you mentioned something earlier, and it made me wonder. You were talking about your mother and that her father had been a very rich man on Hokkaido and even owned his own small town. What happened to them in the war, your mother's family?
I have no idea. She never talked about it. I think, you know, what she did, you know, she went to college, you know, like a junior college in Tokyo. So, you know, left the family behind. That's where she met my father and got married. So I think the previous life was just history. And they were really involved in their present and future life as a Methodist minister and wife.
Have you ever wondered about that, though? I mean, that's your grandfather who's up there in Hokkaido. Have you ever wondered, were those relatives of mine bombed by B-29s? Are they, you know, did they survive the war? Never wondered about that?
Never thought about that. Never entered my mind. I never thought about anything beyond my mother. That was all. The verse never existed, you might say, in my mind.
And what about your service in the 442? And before I forget, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. When all these years after the war, 2011, they say, hey, the Congressional Gold Medal is going to every Nisei veteran, whether he's in the 442nd or the MIS or whatever, we want these men to know that we appreciate what they did. What did that mean to you to receive the Congressional Gold Medal?
Well, that's a lot because that's a very unusual decoration to receive. It made you feel very special. Not too many people have the gold medal, so I was very pleased to be able to get one.
And you know, right now, the Go for Broke National Education Center out of Los Angeles has a traveling exhibit. It's been in Kingsburg, California. It's going to be in Monterey soon. It's in the Midwest right now in Minnesota. It's been in Ohio. But basically, it's the whole point of it is to educate people about what happened during World War II, about Executive Order 9066, about the loyalty test that you guys had to answer to, and about men like you who went over and served even while their families were being held prisoner. What do you think is the most important thing that we can learn from that time in our history? The people today who are alive today who didn't live through that, what should we know about it and what should we learn so it doesn't happen again?
Well, I think that instead of looking at people's race or religion, I think we have to look at people as honest to goodness individual citizens of the United States, and that because of our citizenship, we are actually very special in this world. We're not also very lucky to be living here, and that's why people are always trying to immigrate to the United States, because I think the whole world knows that this is probably the highest level of citizenship and life on this earth.
You're 93 years old. You've done a lot of things in your life. You've experienced things most of us haven't. Is there something that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I guess the thing I'm most proud of was serving in the 442nd as a U.S. Army soldier. I think that was a high point in my life. The other, of course, is my married life and the wonderful wife and kids I had.
I'm not trying to be dramatic or anything, but have you ever stopped and thought, hey, if I was still in that slit trench next to Johnny, I never would have met my wife, my three sons, and my two grandkids would have never been born?
No, I never thought about it in that way. I just accepted things as they happen, as how life goes on, and you make the best of things as they come along. I think the life that I have with my wife here in Sonora is really quite unusual and wonderful, to be living in a small country town, enjoying our neighbors and friends. Just lucky, I guess.
Well, we've all been blessed to hear your story today, and as always, I know all of us have learned a lot. That is Joe Haratani, 93 years old, of Sonora, California, where come September, he and his wife Amy are going to celebrate their 70th wedding anniversary. Find photos of the Haratanis then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. You'll even see that Joe still fits into his Go for Broke uniform after all these years. That is our program for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.